Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo. Do you believe that you can make a difference in the world? Do you believe that there are opportunities for making this world a better place? Well, if you're one of those optimistic souls with a very practical nature, you will thoroughly enjoy the woman that I have as a guest today. Her name is Marilyn Fitzgerald. She is a woman that started on a journey that came from the heart. But she ended up learning some very practical applications that brought her into an understanding about how walking the walk of a humanitarian means you also need to be open to learning new ways of thinking and also new applications of how you can best help others to help themselves. I want to welcome to the airwaves Marilyn Fitzgerald. Hello,
well,
Marilyn.
Hello, Donna, thank you so much for having me today.
Well, it's an absolute delight. I really think that your story is an incredible one. I love the title of your book, If I Had a Water Buffalo. And the subtitle to it is Microfinance as a Means to Sustainability, and we're going to go into that. Dr. Muhammad Yunus, who is a 2006 Nobel Peace Laureate, said about your book, it's an insightful and practical resource forged from the vast experience of the author who challenges each of us to invest in systems that are effective and efficient. Boy, that's the name of the game today. It's wake-up time. We need to know that we can do things differently, number one. Number two, they can be sustainable, so they benefit the planet as well as the life forms that are on this planet, whether it be animal, vegetable, mineral, or whatever you want to call it. I really think that your story is so very, very honest that it really makes a difference when someone takes the time to read it. In one of the very first sentences in your book, you said, regardless of our personal journeys, areas of interest, endeavors, or issues we undertake in life, one of the outcomes is often an assembly of lessons learned. Some are easily learned, while others are often hard fought and finally learned the hard way. Boy, can we relate to that one. I really think, especially the last three words, the hard way. We human beings seem to really enjoy the school of hard knocks as much as we complain. What was it that started you on what you feel the humanitarian quest? Why did you even want to bother? I mean, you live in a country where you have so much abundance, there's so many blessings. Why in the world are you going to decide to go someplace where your deodorant might not work 99.9% of the time, and you may not even have soap and adequate water? Tell me why.
Right. Well, I didn't intend to follow that path, but I had been selected to be a group study exchange team leader to take a team to Indonesia for 6 weeks. And I thought, boy, that'll just be wonderful. I'll be in Bali, Indonesia, and sipping fruit drinks on the beach and having a good time. And my only task was to spread goodwill and understanding. It was through Rotary International. And so I was pretty excited about that and pretty naive also, because for the first time in my life, I also got exposed to extreme poverty. People living in conditions of extreme poverty, children with malnutrition and distended bellies, hair falling out, not enough food, not proper water. So they were dying needlessly at below the age of 5, and found out later that in this country there's 33,000 people dying in this world, 33,000 people dying needlessly every single day. Today, yesterday, tomorrow, the following days, only because they don't have access to clean water, sanitation, proper nutrition, and that just didn't work for me. I think if I've certainly heard about poverty and I've seen the commercials, but I never actually went to the villages and sat with the people and held their children. And these women looked at me as they wanted me to hold their naked, starving babies with such hope in their eyes. And when I left, I thought, well, I didn't even realize it was hope. I had to ask my translator, and I said, why do these women want me to hold their babies? And he was saying, because it gives them hope. They hope something will change because you've been here. I've never had anybody look at me with hope before. Mm-hmm. It felt like such a huge responsibility. And so when I came back, I thought, if they put some hope in me, I certainly have a responsibility to follow through on something. It wasn't just poverty tourism I was on. I was also interested in finding out solutions to that. So I got on a white horse and got involved in humanitarian work all over the world, in Indonesia and Romania and Guatemala, Nicaragua, Bangladesh, and started helping put in water filters and solar ovens and getting food to people, and would come back a couple years later and see many times, not always, but many times failed projects.
Mm-hmm.
And kept thinking, wow, there is just, we care about those numbers of people living in poverty. We must care, because the United States alone gives $6 billion a year out of our pockets. It's not government money. It's not Bill Gates' large foundation money. It's people giving out of their pockets because they've heard of a good cause. Well,
right.
You would think with $6 billion a year, we would have solved this problem a long time ago.
No. And that is a comment. I really think this is important to emphasize. One, the only reason government has money is because of the taxes that they collect from the working population. I don't care
right.
what government you go to.
Right.
The fact that you made the statement, it is the average individual, the average American. And Americans, I don't care what their genetic cultural background is, they have a generosity that is unknown of in the rest of the world. And
right.
I think it's because so many Americans have gone through extreme difficulties, and they feel, I want to give. I'm so blessed. I want to give. I want to help. And you're right. We have got a plethora of organizations that are just dishing out money. And I've done interviews with many different interviews of situations where people say, we've got to just stop giving them money because it's not working. It is
right.
not working. And I want to talk for a moment before we get into a little bit more of this, of how you came to understand this. Because in the Indonesian area, you talk about how the government provides free education, but the families
right.
have to purchase the uniforms and school supplies. Well, the families don't have any money.
Right, right.
They
and
have
even
no
though it's only
way of paying
right.
for this.
That's right. And so there's at least 30,000 children out of school there. And they're working in the rice fields with their parents and doing all kinds of other things, but they're not getting an education. And that's what struck me, is the United Nations put out a report saying the children in Indonesia are in the worst possible condition of any children in Asia. Well, you know what? That includes countries like India, places that we think of. Many people think of Indonesia and think about Bali, Indonesia, and like I did, and that it's all beautiful and wonderful hotels
mm-hmm.
and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But the people less than a mile from the hotel can't afford $60 a year to keep their children in school.
That's right.
And
not only that, but you started an educational funding, a sponsorship program, and man, oh man, did you get a big course in business. When
yes.
it came, because this is a business. There is no such thing truly as a nonprofit organization. If you cannot operate at a profitable level, paying
right.
your bills, taking care of the commitments you make, you're going to have to close.
Right.
And that's what
right.
you found out. Tell us how you discovered that.
Well, an impoverished Indonesian rice farmer, after I had gone to this village and decided through a series of visits that we would fund every child in that village to go to school. We only started out with 20 children. We ended up with 1,200 children. So mm-hmm. that gave us a budget of about $72,000 a year that I was the guiding force in getting that money, because I'm in Rotary and I could get in front of Rotary clubs. And, you know, you tell anybody this story, for $60 a year, you can keep a child in school. They get rice, a cup of rice every day, meat twice a week, a nutritional supplement, uniforms, books, and all that for $60 a year. Come on, we're feeding them and educating them. What could be wrong with that picture?
Mm-hmm.
Well, finally, as we're doing the $72,000 a year, one of the fathers, a rice farmer, came up to me named Naoman, and he said to my translator, "Does she really want to help?" And my translator said, "Yes, she's here. She comes every year and goes back and gets the money for us." And he said, "Well, if she really wants to help, I need a water buffalo." And so when my translator,
I just love it.
So when my translator, Freddie, said, "Well, Naoman said if you really want to help, he needs a water buffalo." And I was busy doing what I was doing and saying, "Yeah, well, we don't do water buffaloes, Freddie, you know, we just do educational sponsorships." But I started, you know, he stood there still, and I started to think about it just for fleeting in my mind and said, "Well, oh, Freddie, why does he want a water buffalo?" And he said if he had a water buffalo, he could triple his rice crop, and he would have enough income to send his own children to school. And he has 3 children on our list of our 1,200 children.
Mm-hmm.
And I was still preoccupied with everything I needed to do for the next couple days. But on the airplane ride home, I started to think about it and thought, wow, I have never had a list go down, you know, or my financial needs for, I always have project creep no matter where I'm working, and it keeps creeping and getting bigger and bigger. And I thought that would be interesting if we were only supporting 1,197 children in school instead of the 1,200 every year. And so I kept faxing back to Freddie, "How much would this cost?" And he said, "About $250. And, okay, that's $180 off my budget every year. That'll help. But I couldn't go back to my donors and say, "Hey, why don't we buy a water buffalo?" Because I had them so sold on these educational sponsorships. I wasn't going to be the one to say, "I've got a better idea today." And so I didn't really know where to get the money or exactly how to do it. But Christmas was coming, so I talked to my family and said, "I want a water buffalo." They said, "What do you want?" And I said, "A water buffalo." And they said, "Yeah, sure, Mom, you know." Thinking I didn't take my malaria pills on my last trip or whatever.
Right.
And so I told them about Freddie, told them about Naoman, and told them that if we got him a water buffalo, it would be like getting him a John Deere tractor. He would be so much more efficient with his work, and he would make more money, and he would have the pride and dignity of supporting his own children in school. So they handed me this box that I thought, well, they didn't hear me, or they don't take it seriously or whatever. But when I opened the box, it was so beautifully wrapped. There were $250 $1 bills. And so with a note that said, "Don't spend it all in one place." But I did. And faxed it all to Freddie, and he got a water buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
And the next year when I went back, there was Naoman in the field. And so he couldn't wait to see me. And usually when Naoman or any of the villagers would see me, they would be humble and their eyes would be downcast. And they would thank me. Well, this time, Naoman is running toward me with his wife and children in tow, making eye contact with me and wants me to walk into the rice field with him, and which I don't like to walk in the rice field because it's murky and there's rice snakes, and I don't like to run into them. They won't hurt you, but I don't like running into them that much, and you're usually about ankle deep in mud. But I thought, all right, fine. So I'm watching for snakes and really wasn't paying attention to where we were going. And when I looked up, there was this most beautiful water buffalo I ever saw in my life. And so Naoman proudly introduced me to the water buffalo that he named Ibu Marilyn, which in Indonesian means Mother Marilyn or Mrs. Marilyn. So how cool was that? I got a water buffalo named after me.
I'll tell you what, that is the biggest compliment you could have ever gotten. When you look into those dark brown eyes, those huge brown eyes of that water bull, and looking at your soul sister. Or his brother. I don't know. But anyway.
She's beautiful. She was up to her shoulders in mud.
Now, one of the things that you said in your book, Marilyn, that to me was very, very profound.
That
Nyoman
very...
had figured out on his own, he had to teach you, but he had figured out on his own how he could get his water buffalo.
Right.
And he wanted to lift his family out of the extreme poverty they were in and dependence on the generosity of strangers. And that is something that a lot of people don't get. It's what is often said in Asia, saving face. How do you, this is a man that loves his family, wants to provide for his family. He doesn't have the technology. In his case, the technology is a water buffalo.
Right.
And that technology enables him to have a sense of pride. He's not challenged by working. He likes to work. His family, he wants his children educated, but he wants to have that level of self-respect. And I think so many times there is this attitude, whether it's politicians or do-gooders of any kind, say, oh, well, I'll just provide for you. Then all of a sudden you don't show up one day. They have become dependent. Their self-sustainability is not there. And out of this, which I just absolutely loved, because of what he did, women around there, the women are the ones that take care of the children typically in these environments, as in almost any environment, but they have to keep their homes, they're feeding their families. These are women that are seeing their children dying. They see what he did. He shares with them what he did. And then they come to you with a request. And I thought, this is so cool. What did the women want from you?
The women asked if they could have the money for 20 piglets. Because if they had the piglets, they would then raise them, and they would sell some to neighboring villages. They would eat some for nutrition. They would use the manure in the rice fields, and they believe, and they would take the excess money that they had and help pay for their children to go to school. And
they also needed some money for fencing and
everything.
For the food to feed the pigs. So what was the total amount that they needed for the 20 little piglets and the fencing and the food for the pigs?
By the time they got the fencing and the food and all that, it was almost $500. But the piglets were only like $120.
Mm-hmm.
But they had, you know, these piglets grow. I don't know about pigs, but anyway, they grow and they have to be contained and they have to stay in a certain area. And it's tough, tough work.
Mm-hmm.
And so they agreed. They had their whole plan included the fencing and the feed and all that for the piglets, and so it started out to be $120, turned into about $500, but they did it, and of course, I still couldn't go back to my donors and say, okay, never mind the educational money, we'll just buy piglets instead, because once you get donors on a track, it's real difficult. First of all, you've convinced them, and now you've got to convince them of something else. So I came back to my family for my birthday and said, okay, for my birthday, I need 20 piglets, and when I told them what we would use the piglets for, I got the money from them. And then, in those days, it was like a fax machine. We didn't have all this great digital stuff. I got this grainy picture fax of these women holding up these 20 piglets under their shoulder blades, smiling into the camera. I think for some of them, it's the first time I ever saw their eyes looking upward with a big sign that said, Happy Birthday, Ibu Marilyn. Which was just wonderful, because then I don't even know how many kids that took off my list, but it took almost everyone off my list. Then the mothers said that the children wanted some hens, and if they had hens, they would have eggs. And in Indonesia, they have a thing called salt eggs, and if you float this raw egg in the shell still, in salt water for 10 days, then it hardens and it turns into a salt egg. I think it's like our pickled eggs. But they sell them the street. Yeah, they sell them on the street for snacks and that kind of thing. So I said, fine. And we got the children the hens. So we had one water buffalo, the piglets, and the hens. And within 3 years, all of those families, all of that $72,000, disappeared, and those families were providing education for their own children.
Right. And now, these are some of the lessons that you learned. Your book is just wonderful to read. And for those of you listening, if you've just tuned in, it's called If I Had a Water Buffalo. This is so important because the lessons that you learned about Indonesia can be applied here in the United States. It can be applied anywhere. And
absolutely.
This is absolutely imperative, that sense of self-sufficiency and self-pride. You lend a hand, not a handout. There's always unintentional consequences of giving. And
right.
One of the biggest detriments is dependency. And it happens too often in different programs. And people get stuck in these programs, and they're not teaching people what, there's an old adage that's been around for centuries. You can teach, you know, you can feed people, or you can teach them how to feed themselves. I'm adjusting it. But it's important. Self-sustainability and self-sufficiency contributes to a sense of positive self-esteem. And you just, you know, there are some groups that are really wise about this, and they work within the cultural environment that they're
right.
in. And I think of a woman that I had the privilege of interviewing about 2 years ago, and she and her husband were very, very wealthy. And her husband decided to sell his multi-million dollar business, and he hands her $1 million. I mean, how many times does that happen to someone? He hands her $1 million and said, go do whatever you want with it. She mm-hmm. looked at him and said, are you really serious? He said, yeah. Well, she decided she was going to go to Africa. And she had a similar situation because she, in her experience, and she would go over, and her husband was brought over. And one of the things that really upset him as an American was the way the women were treated. And she said, well, the only way that this is going to change is if the women have a chance to become educated, if they have a chance to become literate.
Mm-hmm.
So he wanted to go in and just pell-mell, just, oh, we're going to fix this, we're going to build that, we're going to do that, da-da-da-da-da-da. She said, no, we're not. Because she had traveled to this particular area in Africa many times. And she had a woman that came to her and mm-hmm. asked her for a donkey. And she said, I don't understand. She said, I need a donkey. I need to be able to take some things that I've been growing and be able to walk the 20 miles to wherever it was she was going to sell. She said, I need a donkey. And she mm-hmm. said, it was one of the most profound lessons in her life. She said, you find out what people really need. And that's why I was so impressed with your book. Because here you are in another part of the world, and you are learning this lesson, and you are bringing it home, and you also say, give but with conditions, and that's mm-hmm. where we get into lending. And this mm-hmm. is something we need to remember in, it's a good lesson to teach children. I think this would be a great story to share with young people in colleges, anywhere, to have them understand that they're, just like they like to have a sense of self-pride and self-esteem, so do other people. People
right.
really will bite the hand that feeds them eventually because
mm-hmm.
they're going to be very angry. They won't have that sense of self-respect. They're going to be upset that they're kept in what they feel is a level of servitude. And
right.
this, you know, you just, I mean, really, what you've done here is just terrific. You have so many good suggestions. It's marvelous. Now, let's talk about Romania for a minute because this was Indonesia. Here you go to Romania, and for mm-hmm. those of us that are aware of the history and the time under communism and the suffering, women abandoning their babies because they had this ding-dong of a dictator that said every
right.
woman should have 5 children, nobody could afford the kids, they just dumped the babies. I mean, mm-hmm. the stories that came out of Romania were just heartbreaking. Just heartbreaking. And you made a statement, the government had stymied people's ability to dream and hope for what might be within their reach. Okay,
right.
let's talk about how the women in Romania started helping other women.
Are you speaking about the birth?
Diaper bag.
The diaper, oh, okay. Women, it is so amazing because you really can't fathom what is going on in Romania this many years after communism, because well, for a lot of political reasons. But anyway, they don't have the budget. They don't have an income. The government isn't up and running and being able to provide things for people. And this, they lived under communism, and everything was provided for them. Not well, but it was, you know, they weren't used to this freedom of thinking, what can I do to help myself? So the women come in from the villages, sometimes walking days when they're pregnant. They're going to give birth to a child. But you can't enter the hospital if you're poor unless it's within hours of giving birth. So women would get there, they would start walking early in the journey because it might sometimes take them a week to get there. And then they camp out on these boulevards and sleep on outside on the boulevards, waiting until hours before birth when the hospital will admit them. But after the hospital admits them and they have their baby, they have to leave within hours of giving birth. They have nothing. They have nothing, not a receiving blanket, not diapers, not a bottle, not anything. They have a naked baby and their poor selves on their way back to the village. And so the women in Romania, the women that had some resources, put together a diaper bag. So, you know, something we take so for granted. And these women put together, they first bought a safe house for them so they weren't sleeping, some of them. They don't have enough beds, but so they weren't sleeping on the boulevard as much. But when they left the hospital, they had a diaper bag which had a receiving blanket. You and me, Donna, would we have 20 receiving blankets for our children? You know, everybody, you can get receiving blankets like they're disposable towels or something. So these women didn't even have receiving blankets or anything. So the women in Romania got together, a nonprofit organization, and started to provide diaper bags for these women so that they could better care for their children on the walk back home. They mm-hmm. still have maybe another week to get back home and everything with a newborn. Imagine that. And so while the women, the interesting thing was I visited the home for a couple of days, while the women are waiting to give birth or right after they've given birth, those women in the nonprofit organization are teaching them like crazy, teaching them survival skills in the city, how you might be able to start this small business, how you may be able to sell something, how you may be able to support yourself. And for many of these women, it's the first time they've ever, ever had a voice. Or have someone ask them what kind of ideas they have. That was just mind-boggling to me because, you know, in the United States, we've got a zillion ideas, but we grow up believing we can do anything.
Right. That's absolutely
What if you grew
true.
Up in a culture where no one ever asked you, what do you want to be? What can you be? What, you know, we believe that the world is limitless to us, that we have opportunities, all an abundance of opportunities. What if you never knew that was a possibility? For mm-hmm. generations, someone else was telling you what it is you're going to do, never asked you about an idea, and then have that change, have that culture change overnight and say, not only better you come up with some ideas, you better figure out how you're going to support yourself because the government's not doing that either anymore.
Right. And so that's why I think that your voice through the book, through your speaking, whatever you do, is invaluable. And we'll get into micro. Could you stay with me another few minutes? Another 15
sure.
minutes? Wonderful.
Of course.
This
Thank
is Donna Sebo. We're going to take a break for a minute. My guest, if you're just tuning in, is Marilyn Ferguson. Her book is titled, If I Had a Water Buffalo, Microfinance as a Means to Sustainability. I think that this is such an insightful publication, and not from the positioning of, gee whiz, you're doing all these wonderful things. It is a real story about how Marilyn learned you don't go in to try to fix things. You go in and you find out perhaps what is needed and then support people. And we're going to be talking about how this can be done. We're going to be talking about microfinance, how it works, when we come back. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to take a break for a moment, so don't go away. We've got more of Marilyn coming up, and we'll be right back.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Toprasin will work for you, we offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Toprasin. Toprasin is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Toprasin or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Toprasin, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
Hi, this is Donna. I'm interviewing Marilyn Fitzgerald. I had to apologize because I used Ferguson as her last name. It's not Ferguson, it's Fitzgerald. Her book is If I Had a Water Buffalo, Microfinance as a Means to Sustainability. Now, you have a number of chapters in your book, Marilyn, on sustainability, the factor of negotiation, also looking at hope for a sustainable future. And one of the big statements is when it comes to doing something, no matter what form you're going to do it in, the first thing you must remember is do no harm. And I'd like for you to address this because you now are very much still involved in working with programs, and you've got a strong association with the wonderful Rotary organization. And what has been your biggest challenge educating people about the microfinance side? And what have you evolved into in dealing with microfinance? And then explain to my audience what that means in these different cultural environments, whether it's Guatemala, Romania, the middle of Africa. It doesn't make any difference. What does it mean? And how do people have a chance to do this?
Right. Well, when I had first begun in this business, I was really busy riding in on a white horse and fixing things and figuring out the problem and figuring out the solutions, and then was often disappointed that the projects didn't work, that they were not sustainable. Maybe we provided medical equipment or something for a poor village, only to find out it wasn't the right electrical currency, they didn't have replacement parts, they didn't know how to repair it, and so then the machinery is rusted out and sitting in the field. Well, I was contributing to that littered field of failed projects and started to try to figure out what can work, what does work. I was beginning to see a lot of things that didn't work and getting discouraged. And if I come back to the donors and tell them all these things don't work, of course the money dries up. And so I started to be on a quest to figure out what does work. And how can we provide, why is sustainability so important in humanitarian aid? Because we don't want people living off charity, and guess what? People don't want to live off charity. It robs mm-hmm. people of their voice and choice and dignity, and we don't want to do that to people. So I was around looking at projects that were not dependent on the donors. Every project I'd been involved in prior to that, the project was dependent on the donors someone had to go hustle up the money every year. If you didn't do that, there'd be no more project. That was harmful. It took me a while to understand that's causing harm to people. I'm a psychologist. I took an oath to cause do no harm. And here I started to realize many of the projects I myself had been involved in were causing harm, because when the dollar, our dollars dried up, their project went away. Maybe their education went away. Maybe their food source went away. So when in a search for sustainable projects, I ran across microfinance projects, which I had spent years taking pictures of starving children with sad, dirty faces and falling out hair, and I would just pull on everyone's heartstrings and get money out of their pockets. Then I started to look at microfinance programs, and I was taking pictures of happy, smiley, self-confident people. People that otherwise, you know, you had referred to the saying before, give a man a fish and he eats for a day, teach a man to fish and he eats for a lifetime. Nyoman, the rice farmer, was trying to tell me he knows how to fish. He knows how to do this if I could just listen to him or ask something. And then his pride and dignity came up when he was able to take care of himself. So then the first time I ran into microfinance was in the Western Highlands in Guatemala, and there were these groups of women that were getting teeny little microloans, less than $100. And they were involved in a peer lending group so that they would all have their own businesses, and they would all take out these teeny little loans, and maybe they were weavers or we have a chocolate maker. We have someone that leases land and sells flowers. And those businesses, after they pay back the loan, which is usually, like I said, less than $100 to begin with, and they pay it back within about 6 months with 2% interest, then they're eligible for another loan. And that loan may be about $250 in that range. And their business begins to grow. And they have employed other people sometimes along with their business. Those projects were the difference between night and day, the difference between giving someone something that truly needs it or helping someone find an opportunity to support themselves. And those pictures change from sad faces to happy faces. And guess what? You get the money back again. They pay it back again. It's amazing.
Yes.
With
in
interest.
Fact, yeah, this is something that with the microloans, and the gentleman's name that actually started this in a small country, he was seeing such desperate situations. The men were not working. The women were always working hard, and nobody was supporting the women. And he took a very, very long stretch of risk doing this with the women, and he got feedback from religious leaders. They were upset because the women were developing independence. But they gave these microloans to the women, and they did not have one woman default on a loan. And if they were having a problem, what he did, he would have staff at his bank educate the women. And these women now, after a number of years, not only are they self-sufficient, but they have sent their children where they could get the education. They themselves continue to expand their education. And I think it is absolutely phenomenal. And I wish we could incorporate something like this in the United States, because not everybody's going to need $500 million for projects.
Absolutely, and you know, we do have it in the United States. I visited 5 different projects in New York City that are affiliated with the Grameen Bank, and that's what Muhammad Yunus, Nobel Peace Prize winner, began. And he's got 4 Grameen branches in New York City, and they are amazing women. When you see those little flower stands on the street and you see some of those street vendors, those were started with microloans. They've got about 2,500 borrowers in New York City. Their loans go up to $1,000. But it's a start, and I sat in their repayment groups. They come and repay. They have to pay every week. And so I was sitting in their repayment groups, and it is exactly like what happens in Guatemala and Bangladesh and the other microloan programs I've seen. We have gone under the myth all these years of saying in order to be a good borrower, you have to have good credit and collateral, or you won't pay back your loan. Well, guess what we found out? That these people have got a 98% repayment rate with interest. They have no collateral. They have no credit history, and they're excellent borrowers. And so it's time to put that myth to sleep, because that myth has not proven true over the last 20 years that Mohammed Humans has been working with microloans. These people are paying back the money. It's their only opportunity to get money. They pay back the money, and they hold each other responsible. That's what's so wonderful about peer lending, is there no one's going to come knocking on your door except someone from your group. You're not going to have some other creditor there, and if you can't make your payments, someone is going to help you find out how you can start making your payments. And let's say, Donna, you're growing a crop that you sell, but and you've taken out a loan, but your crop isn't ready to harvest yet, but you still have a loan payment due. And I'm a weaver, so I'm going to help you with your loan payment until your crop comes in. Then you're going to take over your own loan payments and pay me back for what it is that I helped you with, and your business will grow. And so that peer lending, for me, is just such a key, because they hold each other accountable.
I think it is incredible. And I'm so thrilled that you're sharing this information, because this is something I wondered, how in the world could this start in the United States? Because there are so many aspects of strength when it comes to the microlending factor. Not everybody wants to become a multi-level corporation. And there's so many different levels to healthy economic levels, bases in any kind of a free society. And you need all of them. Whether it's a small level of income to super colossal, it doesn't make any difference. When you take and look at the basic sustainability of any free, healthy society and their economy, whenever you look at it, it is what you call the middle class.
Right.
Anything from the lower middle class to the upper middle class, and everything above it and below it. But that middle class is what creates the sustainability. And I think that this is just fabulous. It offers jobs. It gives opportunities. This is quite exciting. Quite exciting. Now, I know, Marilyn Fitzgerald, that you have a website that people can go to find out more information about if they're wanting to do something to benefit other people. Your book, If I Had a Water Buffalo, gives so much sound information. I just think it's marvelous. What is the website they should go to?
mafitzgerald.com.
mafitzgerald.com. What are they going to find when they go to your website?
When they go to my website, they're going to see three different categories, and one is speaking, consulting, ordering the book if they're interested in the book. Mm-hmm. And they're also going to see pictures, lots of wonderful pictures of women in microloan projects. They'll see the women's product, and they'll see formulas on how they went about making that happen for themselves. And so they'll see the women's individual stories, and they'll see the techniques and strategies on how you go about working with a microfinance program and why you want to do that, why you want to start at that grassroots level. And like you said, Donna, build up from there so that they can have a middle class.
Mm-hmm.
And so that we can rescue our middle class, so that these people, as they build up themselves, they also build social capital, self-esteem, dignity. What are you going to pay for those?
You cannot.
You can't buy that. But
that's
you can
priceless.
Give people an opportunity to get there for that.
Absolutely.
And that's what people have really missed out on, the opportunity. And we always talk about America being the land of opportunity, but we don't know what that means until we meet people that have no opportunities.
Mm-hmm. I think your words, Marilyn Fitzgerald, are very, very profound. I think your story is fabulous. I think that anyone that would like to read about it, one, they'll appreciate the blessings they've got in a free country that supports the aspect of reach for your dreams, whatever they might be. They're not inconsequential. You have them for the reason of fulfilling them in one way or another.
But I also think it's important for us to understand that this is a world that, due to technology, we are able to communicate information so much more effectively and efficiently. And because of this, it is taking the opportunity to build in the right way, in a way that is, again, sustainable, gives those qualities of character and definition that encourages the future generations, because the older generations are experiencing them. And that's what's important. And I think
right.
It gives opportunity on so many levels for young people to become involved. There's just so much information in your book, If I Had a Water Buffalo, Microfinance as a Means to Sustainability. I really appreciate your giving me your extra time. Thanks so much, Marilyn Fitzgerald, and continue to do the good work.
Thank you so much, Dan. I appreciate you talking with me.
It's been a pleasure. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. Don't forget to check out mafitzgerald.com. We're going to be right back.
Do you have children between the ages of 3 to 10? Do you love children's books and collect them? Then you'll want to know about God's Kiss, the award-winning illustrated children's book that has been enjoyed by families around the world. 15 beautiful illustrations by Pacific Northwest artist Ed Gedrose accompany this lovely story about a little boy named Johnny that will capture your heart and mind in a very special way. Multicultural and non-denominational in content, it will become a family favorite that you and your children will want to read again and again. This book is available by itself through Amazon, or if you contact me, Donna Sebo, directly, you can get a personalized signed copy. There is also a talking book. You can order the talking book CD by contacting me via email, donna@delphiinternational.com, or by calling 253-582-5604. You can also visit my website, delphiinternational.com, to see more details. God's Kiss is a family classic that belongs in everyone's library. Get your copy now. Have you ever had a friend tell you about a product they really believed in? Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Toprosin is a homeopathic cream that is just fabulous. I use it and my friends use it for relief of painful discomfort such as aching muscles and sore feet. Odorless, non-greasy, it is a product that belongs in everyone's medicine cabinet and first aid kit. Check out www.toprosin.com. That's T-O-P-R-I-C-I-N. And find out more information. You can order Toprosin online or call 800-959-1007. That's 800-959-1007. Be sure to give them the code DS30 and you'll receive a 30% discount. Toprosin, non-toxic, safe for children too. This is a product that really works. Try it. I think you'll like it.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. And if you'd like to call in and chat with me, 888-627-6008 is the telephone number to call into. That's 888-627-6008. Quickly, I want to let you know that we've got a phenomenal lineup next week, and I hope you'll share this with your friends so that they can tune in as well. Find the Upside of the Down, Dr. Rob Bennington. This is a man that has walked a path that really taught him some very significant lessons. So he's going to be with us on Monday. And then on Tuesday, we're going to be talking with Joseph Higgins. And I love the title of his book, Hello, Anybody Home? Well, definitely there is. But Joseph is a medium, and he will share with us his experiences of developing his own mediumship, speaking with people on the other side of life. It's really a delightful book. And then David Kopp, Cancer, It's a Good Thing I Got It. You don't know of many men, I'm sure you have not heard of many men, who have ended up with breast cancer. Well, David did. It totally changed his life, and this is his story. And then, Lessons of the Law, Scott Hammond. We're going to be talking about search and rescue dogs. Absolutely wonderful story. And then, Why Bother with Peter Balegas. This is a week that's going to be inspirational. It's going to make you aware that there are so many lessons in life we all have a chance to learn, and when we can share them, we empower other people to know that they, too, can. Well, so not only survive adversity, but also have experiences that will enrich their lives in a phenomenal way. I should say enrich their lives in a phenomenal way. Well, I have a recipe here that I wanted to share with you for sweet and sour chicken. Ah, yes. Oh, and one of the things I'm going to share with you on the air probably next week is something that I have incorporated into my daily routine for wellness, and it's all about an item called kombucha. K-O-M-B-U-C-H-A. You can look it up on Wikipedia, but next week I'll give you information on it. It is absolutely amazing stuff, and I'm just thrilled. I learned about it through a friend, and it's been around for centuries, but it's really good. Well, anyway, the sweet and sour chicken recipe is just absolutely wonderful. And if you're like me, when you go out to a restaurant, especially an Asian restaurant, if they make a real good sweet and sour soup, it's just like, oh, this is just perfect, especially during the winter, because it's just such, it just makes your whole body feel good. And sweet and sour chicken, many times when you have it, it is in an Asian restaurant, it's dipped in batter, it's got a whole bunch of stuff around it, and the sauce is really what makes everything taste good. But this is not done in deep frying, with deep frying. So let me share this with you because it is so easy. All you need is 1.5 cups of Marsala wine. You're going to need a large onion, and you want this onion chopped fine. You need 3 whole cloves of garlic. You need an additional 3 cloves of garlic, and you want to chop that finely. And then you're going to need 1 large bay leaf, 6 chicken breasts, and, you know, I think it's the average weight, about 6 to 7 ounces each chicken breast. And you want the skin on it. You want to leave the skin on it. And then you want a little bit of flour, and you're going to season that with salt and pepper. You're going to need 3 ounces of olive oil, 10 ounces of chicken broth, 3 tablespoons of sugar, and 6 ounces of red or white vinegar. And you're going to need, if you like this, you don't have to include it, this is optional, 1/4 cup of raisins and 1/4 cup of pine nuts. Now, this is how simple the recipe is. You combine your masala wine, your onion, your cloves. Oh, I forgot to say 3 whole cloves. I neglected to put that in there. 3 cloves, garlic, all of the garlic, and bay leaf. Now, you put that in a saucepan, stir it quickly. Just before it comes to a boil, your 6 chicken breasts, you need to have a big, shallow glass baking dish. You put your chicken breasts in there. You cover it, again, this liquid mixture, you pour it over the chicken breast. And then you cover the dish with, I'd say, some plastic wrap, and then foil over that. Refrigerate overnight, or if you're having a barbecue, then refrigerate it for 6 hours. You're going to want to take the breast, once they've marinated, you want to dredge it in some seasoned flour and saute in a large skillet for 3 or 4 minutes on each side until they're nice and golden, and then put them aside on a platter. Any excess oil from your skillet, now remember, the skin is on the breast, any excess oil from the skillet, you pour off, and you get rid of the cloves and the bay leaf in the marinade that is left, and then you add the marinade to the skillet. You simmer it for about 5 minutes, put the chicken breast back in the skillet, and you want to spoon the sauce over the breast. You then add your chicken broth, you stir everything well, cook it for 15 minutes, turning the chicken one time or more. While it's simmering in a little saucepan, while the chicken mixture is simmering, in a little saucepan you take sugar and you heat it, and the sugar starts to melt. It'll turn a golden color. Then you carefully, in that sugar, stir in your vinegar, and if you want, your raisins and your pine nuts, and you pour this mixture over your chicken breasts 2 or 3 minutes before they're done. This is a recipe by Chef Salvador J. Campagna. It is really, really good, and it has wonderful flavor. Serve it with rice or maybe serve it with noodles. Something that is so delicious, sweet and sour, and it's absolutely marvelous. You can garnish the plate with a little bit of parsley and just have a magnificent meal. And if you wanted to, you probably could take those chicken breasts if you wanted to barbecue them. But the sauce, then you'd have to cook in a separate pan so that then you could spoon it over the chicken breast. But this is a wonderful, wonderful recipe. So I wanted to share that with you. My goodness, we are almost out of time. This is Donna Siebel. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. There is so much in life that we can do. A person can make a difference. My guests today, as all of my guests, I feel, do, prove that one person can make a difference. And you need to know that you can make a difference. Like Marilyn Fitzgerald, if you feel that there's something you want to do, be willing to learn, be willing to educate yourself. Her book, If I Had a Water Buffalo, is so informative. It makes us aware that anytime we get involved in something that might be close to our heart, we need to open our minds and our attitudes to different perspectives, different paradigms. And in doing that, you can't help but grow and expand as a person. This is Donna Sebo. Have an utterly magnificent weekend. Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, remember, this is your life. Live it, enjoy it, savor its gifts, because you truly are blessed beyond your wildest dreams. Bye-bye. Talk with you on Monday.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.